Meet Caitlin Cronenberg.
I come from this horror film family. I'm super proud of my lineage and my father and my brother's films.
Her father, David, gave us Scanners, Dead Ringers, and Videodrome. And her brother, Brandon, recently directed Infinity Pool. Caitlin made her feature directing debut last year with Humane, a film rich with her family's DNA, but also uniquely her own. Welcome back to listener-supported KPBS Cinema Junkie. I'm Beth Accomando. Caitlin Cronenberg's Humane is a delicious social satire and a savage family drama, but it doesn't announce any of its intentions. Instead, it lets its story slowly unfold so that the attentive viewer can have the pleasure of discovery. It's a smartly crafted film with Cronenberg revealing a confidence and maturity not usually found in a first-time director. But perhaps that's the benefit of being raised in a creative family. I got to talk to her about growing up as David Cronenberg's daughter and about making her feature directing debut. I need to take one quick break, and then I'll be back with Caitlin Cronenberg.
KPBS On Demand is supported by Bilhaugh Plumbing, Heating, and Air Restoration and Flood Services. Family-owned and operated over four decades, Bilhaugh has been serving the plumbing, heating and air, and water damage needs of the San Diego area since 1980. With their fleet of trained professionals, Bilhaugh has the ability to service all major and minor plumbing and HVAC emergency needs 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Bilhaugh is committed to providing excellent service to their customers with transparent quotes and attention to detail on every job. Whether you're in need of an HVAC installation, plumbing, or water damage restoration in San Diego, they offer the convenience of scheduling an appointment over the phone, online, or through live chat on their website. Call 1-800-BILHAUGH or visit bilhaugh.com, because we know how.
Welcome back to Cinema Junkie. I'm Beth Accomando. Here's the trailer for Caitlin Cronenberg's Humane, which stars Peter Gallagher, Emily Hampshire, and Jay Baruchel.
While we every day bear witness to the catastrophic ecological collapse that is plaguing our planet, we must not forget that this is, above all, a human crisis.
I am in favor of this government doing whatever it takes to win this war.
It's not a war. Wars have opposing sides.
Humanity is the opposing side. We are engaged in nothing less than a life and death struggle against our own extinction.
We are so happy you all joined us tonight for a family dinner.
What is going on?
We've decided to enlist.
What?
She's gone.
Sorry, I can't do it. I will always love you.
Hi, I'm Bob.
It's them!
Oh, they're early.
You're not gonna like this, but we're here to collect two bodies.
I already told you Dawn left.
And that's unfortunate. But the rules are the same for everybody.
Caitlin, I am very excited to find out that Humane is going to start streaming on Hulu, which means I get to recommend it again and more people get to see it. So first of all, just tell people what this film is about.
What is this film about? Well, it is at its core a family drama, but then, you know, if you go one step further, we like to refer to it as a family thriller. So Humane is about a kind of a future present, which we hope doesn't happen, where the government has sort of introduced this voluntary euthanasia program in order to call the world's population after an environmental collapse, where we realize we just do not have enough resources to support the population as it stands. You know, it sounds very heavy. It sounds very environmentally fraught, which it is, but the story really does focus on one family and how they exist in this crazy world. So although you're getting sort of hints about what's happened worldwide, the world doesn't feel as large as the, you know, as the log line or the synopsis sounds.
And how did you come upon this story? What made you decide to make this? Because this is your first feature directing, correct?
Correct, yes. Well, so Michael Sparaga, who wrote the film, has been a friend of mine for a very long time. And up until this point, I was working on his projects as a photographer, which is my career up until this point as well, and continues to be. But he sent me the script kind of out of the blue and said, have you ever thought about directing features? And I had been thinking about it, but I hadn't mentioned it to him. So it was kind of fortuitous timing. And when I read the script, I just couldn't get over, well, first of all, it was very dark and funny, both at the same time, which is something that I really love. But it was so original and it was so smart. And it was telling a large story in a small way, which I felt like was something I could do taking on a first feature. However, I forgot and didn't realize until we were on set that almost every scene has four people in it. And it's a really hard thing to do, to figure out where all of these people are going to go and and have all of their dialogue. And there's a lot of dialogue, which is, it was hugely fun, a great challenge, and just so different from anything else I'd ever done. But it was really his script that just stuck with me. Just, I read it and then it became COVID. He wrote it pre-COVID. And as we were living through COVID and talking about this idea, we started to see things that we never thought we would see in our lifetime, like billboards for masks for children and all of these terrifying ads about dying from COVID if you don't do this or that. And it just made us so much more passionate about the project because we thought, okay, well, we're all living through this. We don't want to make a movie about this, but it's almost a reimagining of a different way that it could have gone, where more extreme steps have to be taken.
So you've sort of implied a little bit about the tone of this film. It's really tricky to navigate. So I'm curious, I mean, it is darkly funny. It's chilling. It is a family drama. So tackling that as a director, like, how do you kind of navigate that tricky tone and make sure like you're hitting the right notes in each scene?
I mean, so much of it did come together tonally in the editing room. The thing is that our cast was just so good. And, you know, you're working with comedic actors who are also dramatic actors, but they all have phenomenal senses of humor and great comedic timing. And we were really able to get such range from take to take. You know, no two takes were the same. No take was a waste. And in the edit, as we, you know, watched the film through, it was either, this is too bleak for this moment. Let's, you know, find a take where Jay did something funny, just the delivery being different. But I think for me, you know, I come from this horror film family. I'm super proud of my lineage and my father and my brother's films, but I didn't see this as a traditional horror film in any way. It really, you know, some people have called it a horror film. Some people are upset by people calling it a horror film because it doesn't follow the traditional tropes of horror. But it was kind of interesting to watch it play out and say, wow, okay, he's coming through really sinister right now. That's good. We want him to be, or we're not ready for this character to show, you know, this side of their personality yet. I didn't think about it too much beforehand. It was every day, it's you shoot the pages, you get the best performances out of these phenomenal actors, you feel happy, and then you go to the editing room and say, let's make it feel like the flow makes sense, which was very challenging because I'd never edited anything either or been in an editing process. And there are so many possibilities and ways that you can change things. You can change the story. You can do all of this magic, which is, you know, as I prepare to hopefully at some point make another film, the awareness and the experience that I now have from making this film, you know, goes a long way. But yeah, I think I didn't overthink it. I think I just went with feeling and said, I want to do justice to the script as written. And the actors felt the same way. And I gave them all my trust because they're all veterans and have done this many more times than I have.
And how did your photography background play into this in terms of how you decided to shoot this?
Well, I definitely needed to team up with a DP who was as nerdy about lighting as I am, but actually has the technical know-how and the ability to shoot motion. And so Doug Coe is our DP, and he's nerdier than I am, which made it even more fun. But we talked a lot about each moment being beautiful. Even the most mundane feeling moments needed to feel beautiful. And again, it's just having this team where people understand the things that I felt were important and they felt that they were important too. And that gave us the ability to really lean in. But there was a point in the, you know, pre-production and during production where I gave in completely, because you cannot micromanage any of these departments. So you say, okay, I've given you my trust entirely and let's do it. And we had such a great, wonderful crew and there was no misstep, you know, in that. Of course, you know, it's a low budget film. We're working with what we've got, very few days, making the most of our days and trying not to burn out. But Doug was so wonderful as a collaborator. And he and I would look at paint chips because we painted the inside of the house, because every single scene takes place in this house. And so we're thinking, okay, well, let's look at these chips. We looked at them outside. We looked at them under different kinds of light. We're thinking, okay, how are we going to select? And just the dedication just gave me all the confidence that I needed to go forward. And everything was beautiful. And that was like number one for me, is anytime you freeze a frame here, it should be beautiful.
And as a first-time director on a feature, how did that kind of confined setting play out for you in terms of, was it helpful or was it a challenge? Because it was like this, like sometimes for artists, I feel like restrictions are actually a good thing. Like it makes them more creative. But I was just wondering how you felt about that limited sort of space.
Yeah, I think it was both. I think it was a help and a hindrance at times. You know, having the house to explore and using the actual layout of this physical house as the layout in the film, it did give us a chance to, as a unit, you know, the cast, like we didn't have time to spend time together as a family. And, you know, you hear about people who are about to play siblings and they spend all this time together getting to know each other. We didn't have that, but we were all in the house all the time. You know, the green room was in the house, everything was in the house. So, in a way, it was great because we did get to know the inner workings of this house. But there were days when, you know, we would all joke, okay, we're back in the foyer again. How are we going to make this look different than the previous seven times we've been in the foyer this week? But it was fun to work with Doug and with the actors during blockings to say, okay, well, what can we do? Where did you stand last? How can we, you know, make the entrances and exits more interesting? You do think that it will be easier being in one location in many ways. And in many ways it is, production wise, but it does force you to get creative with things that you never thought you'd have to get creative with. But, you know, again, we knew that was the case. However, when I'm sent scripts that take place largely in one house now, I'm thinking, you know, I think I'll branch out. I think we'll move past this and maybe have a couple of additional locations.
One of the things I really loved about this film and about your brother's film and your dad, but your film drops us into the future, but you don't take a lot of time explaining that. There's a lot of films where they'll take all this exposition and they'll say like, oh, we're in this year and this happened. And I love in your film and your brother's, like, you're in some place that feels like the real world, but slowly you start to realize there are some things that are very, very different for reasons you don't yet understand. And I love that you like don't treat the audience like idiots. Like you let us go like, no, I'm going to let you figure this out.
Thank you for saying that. That was, you know, that was a goal of ours, is to give in and trust the audience and understand that these are smart people that are watching this film and we shouldn't be too expository. Let them figure out what's happened. But, you know, part of that is we didn't have the time. We didn't have an additional half hour of the movie and an additional 10 days to shoot it. But I liked that challenge. And Michael Spraga, the writer, we liked that challenge together to think, how can we use these little blips on the radio, on the TV, to show the extent of what's happening here? But at the same time, we wanted it to feel as scary as it could possibly feel in terms of this could happen to us. The clips that we pulled off the TV to show, those are all real. Nothing was made up. You know, the fires, gosh, and with the LA and with everything that's happening, like you think about these environmental disasters and how close we are to them, just period, full stop. Things are happening all the time and it's only getting worse. So the idea that it was an alternate present, you know, you still have the same cell phone, you still have the same, you know, you're not in a flying car, but your car does tell you what the UV index is. You're in the same house, but you do need film on your windows. And the idea was that we weren't even a full year into this environmental collapse, so that those who were more well off were able to actually get the official window coverings and the fancy cars and the good umbrellas. And those who were, you know, struggling a bit more financially would have to make their own umbrellas with tinfoil inside and, you know, close up their own windows. And I liked that it could feel very normal. And then there would just be these little moments, and, you know, with lighting, we played with the fact that we actually put this film on the windows that stopped down the light coming from outside, and we would have the sunlight blasting through, but it wouldn't be as strong coming in. So there would be a mix of this stopped down daylight and lamplight in the middle of the day. And that was something that, you know, it's kind of eerie and you may not totally clue in to what it is, but you can sense that there's an eeriness happening. And those are the kinds of things that, the kinds of details that we liked to add in without explaining them. And then it's fun because people can discover them if they feel like they want to. And if not, they're kind of feeling an eeriness as they experience the film, whether they understand why or not quite.
Well, and some of those details you mentioned also go to kind of the layers that are in the film, because they do also imply this social class structure where it's not just this environmental issue that's going on, but yeah, some people have it easier than others. And how does that play out in the world? And you know, how does that make us feel?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it was, I think, you know, having the character of Bob be the one to really express, you know, that he doesn't go to houses like this very often. He's not often in neighborhoods like this. You know, he has sat with all of these different people from all these different walks of life, and he sees their struggles, and he himself has been through this struggle. Is it a social commentary? Yeah. I'm not trying too hard to be political. I'm not trying too hard to really lean into that, because I really just wanted the film to play out, and everyone's willingness to look into it and to think about it is exciting, and I love that. But it is part of our day-to-day life, right? Every person that we encounter has their own life and their own situation and their own, you know, state of well-being or not. And I think it feels very real to encounter people day-to-day and not necessarily know how to interact with them in a way. And there's always this sort of unsettling, you're trying to figure each other out. And that was part of this, Bob's journey through navigating this family dynamic.
You think I'm the bad guy, but I'm doing important work to save the planet.
We can get through this, but we have to stick together.
It's been a hell of a night, huh?
I need to take one last break, and then I'll be back with the rest of my interview with Caitlin Cronenberg, who explains what it's like to grow up with David Cronenberg as her dad.
Well, I mean, you would see things, certainly. We had a mugwump in our basement for a while and a typewriter with an anus.
KPBS On Demand is supported by Bilhau Plumbing, Heating, and Air Restoration and Flood Services. Family-owned and operated over 4 decades, Bilhau has been serving the plumbing, heating, and air, and water damage needs of the San Diego area since 1980. With their fleet of trained professionals, Bilhau has the ability to service all major and minor plumbing and HVAC emergency needs 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Bilhau is committed to providing excellent service to their customers with transparent quotes and attention to detail on every job. Whether you're in need of an HVAC installation, plumbing, or water damage restoration in San Diego, they offer the convenience of scheduling an appointment over the phone, online, or through live chat on their website. Call 1-800-BILHOW or visit bilhau.com, because we know how.
So I follow Francis Ford Coppola on Instagram, and I love seeing every now and then he runs these like old home movies or something where he's showing his kids performing or doing something creative. And you've grown up in a very creative family. Your brother, your father, your aunt are all very creative. So I'm just wondering, what kind of a childhood did you have in the sense of, was creativity supported, encouraged? Like, what was that like?
Oh, for sure. Creativity was everything in our family. Like, my brother and I were always drawing, doing art projects. I think, you know, our parents were hugely supportive of any endeavors. You know, if I said, I want to make a chair, I want to build something, off we would go to Home Depot. We would buy lumber. They would let me use power tools. It was a very free feeling to explore things and try things. And, you know, my brother wanted to, when he went to film school, obviously that was exciting for everybody, but I went to school for fashion design. I then picked up photography. There was never a time where my parents said, okay, but also you have to be a lawyer too. And obviously, you know, being a successful artist is very hard and very rare. And, you know, there are certainly days when I think maybe I should also be a mailman because it would be nice to have a steady job. I've thought about that many times. And I know many artists who have too, or often we all have, you know, day jobs, but it never came from our parents. They were, and still are, very excited about, you know, any of our creative endeavors. But my mom used to always say that I would fill whatever space I was in with projects. And I could never just be in one project. I would have to make something. I would always have to be making something. So I would be making, you know, a house for my hamster, or, you know, drawing a giant something, or, and it was just allowed. I was allowed to do that. And that, I think, has given me all of the structure and just even, you know, my mom's no longer alive, but just sort of knowing that she would have been supportive of anything that I wanted to do. And my dad remains supportive of everything that we want to do. It does give you this confidence, even from a young age, that art is good. And I try to give that to my kids too, and give them the freedom to, sure, use all the paper, cut out my printer paper and make little robots on it and do whatever you need to do. And then they'll find what they want. But if they have art as a way to express themselves, even if it doesn't end up being their career, then it's always there just to be an outlet. And I think that that's really valuable.
And did you and your brother like grow up on your dad's sets? Do you remember like visiting sets, or were you kind of kept separate from that?
No, we would always visit. It would be the biggest treat, especially if it was at night, a night shoot, because then you think, oh, it's dark and it's past my bedtime and I get to be here. And, you know, the smell of the sets that had just been built, like the carpentry smell, was something that sort of ingrained in my mind forever. But for us, it was mostly the excitement of getting snacks on the craft truck and, you know, seeing all the crew members who had known us for our whole lives. And it was super exciting. But, you know, he shot most of his stuff locally when we were of a certain age. But, you know, we did spend several weeks in Beijing when he was shooting at Butterfly. And I think before I could really remember, we were in London for several things. And it was, you know, it's a very special thing. But you learn to appreciate it as a job instead of idolizing it. And I think that's one of the reasons that a lot of children of filmmakers become filmmakers, or children of actors become actors, because you can see it as a job and you see it as accessible because you're thinking, well, all these people are here doing this job. This could be my job. You know, and people who haven't had that kind of closeness with the industry might think, well, this is a job that is untouchable. And so I think that's why it's so encouraging for family members to sort of follow in the footsteps, as it were. And my kids, you know, my kids have come to my photo sets for their entire lives. That changed a bit during COVID because they weren't allowed to come anymore. But my older son got to visit us on the set of Humane. But they both got to come and visit my dad on his last set too. And it's all very sweet. You know, it's everybody's so kind to children on set, and you've been working these long days and here come these little faces and you just want to feed them gummy bears and watch their eyes light up as they see the cameras and the lights. And it is really a magical thing.
And you refer to your family as a horror family. So when you went to these sets, were you kind of aware as a child that the stories that were being told might be scary, or was it just like, hey, I'm with dad at work?
Well, I mean, you would see things, certainly. We had a mugwump in our basement for a while and a typewriter with an anus sitting on the coffee table. So you know that things are not quite as straightforward as maybe some of your other friends' parents' jobs. But, you know, it depended on the set and the day. And I think that probably my parents kept me away from the really, really gory, heavy sex days. But you would certainly see interesting props and kind of understand that this doesn't feel like a kid's movie. I probably won't see this one, that kind of thing. But, you know, you get a sense of what's going on. And it's so funny because as a family, we're very quiet. I would say, like, we're quiet people. My dad and my brother are big readers, very cerebral. Everybody's very sweet, unpretentious. We love hanging out, eating dinner, playing Boggle. Like, it's not what people may think we would be like, or at least them. I'm an open book.
Well, I feel the same way. Like, I've interviewed Clive Barker, and I feel like with your dad and with Clive Barker, if you met them at a cocktail party and didn't know who they were, you would never guess, like, oh, these people make the craziest, like, body horror and terrifying kind of movies and books.
Yeah, and I feel like that kind of works, too. I think personalities don't often reflect the work of artists. It goes both ways, of course, but especially artists who have been doing it for so long, it feels like they really use the art as their outlet, and that doesn't sort of seep into their personality as a whole.
One of the things that I think is great about your work and your brother's is you can obviously see that you have your dad's DNA, like, it's clear, but you both have unique voices as well. And I'm just curious, like, what do you feel about, like, the way your creativity was greeted by your parents that kind of helped you kind of develop those unique voices instead of like, oh, be like me kind of?
I mean, I think they never, the messaging was never be like me. And it was always, you know, you can do what you want. You don't have to do this. But, you know, my brother, because he writes his material as well. And I haven't at this point I didn't write my first feature, but he's always been just like an incredibly creative person with his own voice, writing stories, drawing pictures, coming up with these really intricate characters. And so it was always, that was always what it was going to be for him once he decided that he would be part of, you know, this industry. I think for me, because I spent so long as a photographer before I delved into the directing side of things, I think my voice developed differently because it was a visual first voice. I think, you know, growing up in a family that embraces darker themes gives you permission to explore them in your own way, which is very, very, I mean, it's very supportive feeling. I could have easily gone into rom-coms only. You know, I watch a lot of Gilmore Girls. Like, this is, it could have gone either way for me, and it still might. I would never say, no, I'm never going to make a rom-com, because I enjoy those kinds of films too. But I think it was very freeing to explore my own kind of inner darkness and love of the strange and the way that strangeness and beauty intertwine. But exploring that in photography is much easier than exploring it in film, because you can really just take your camera out and shoot whatever's in front of you. Filmmaking is a team sport. So is photography, but photography can be an alone sport too. I think just when your family says, oh yeah, you want to make a book of just 200 naked people that you're just shooting alone in your studio and you're 20, that's cool. Just make sure you're safe and make sure everyone feels safe and comfortable and do your thing. And then I would print these, you know, I have this self-published book called Poser with just portraits of naked strangers and naked friends. And I would just print them out and show them to my mom and say, look, this is what I shot. She'd be like, oh, that's really cool. Like, oh, I really like their facial expression. And that's not every family. So there is a safety net. You feel safe to explore anything you want, as long as you are safe and no one else is in danger. You're not making anyone feel unsafe. And that is certainly something that I don't take for granted. However, also my parents always felt like parents. You know, they felt like my anchors and my rocks. And even though they give me and my brother, they gave us a lot of freedom, we always had this, and still do with our dad, this very close friendship and relationship. But I think now that I'm a parent, I mean, I've been a parent now for 9 years, and something that is very important to me is to make sure that my kids know that they're going to have lots of freedom to do various things, but there will still be rules and I'm still their parent. But I think as a kid, you really crave that. You want that stability from your parents. You don't want your parents to only be your friends. You need them to be the shoulder, you know?
So here in San Diego, we put on a rave party for Videodrome. And we were looking for images to put on a wall of TVs from the film and also from elsewhere. And I discovered something called The Death of David Cronenberg, which we put a clip of on there. And then I found out you were involved in that.
Oh, yeah.
And so I'm just curious, how did you approach your dad to say, like, Dad, I want to do this thing where it's you and your corpse? I don't know.
Well, the concept was his. It was his concept. So I was exploring the NFT space for a while and creating, you know, selling my art as NFTs and really getting into understanding this phase of digital art and where it might be going. I've since stepped back only because it is all-encompassing. You know, you really have to stay plugged in, and I wanted to explore filmmaking. And so I have many friends who are NFT artists, and I know that they're, you know, grinding every day. But for me, I needed to take a step back. But I said to my dad, you know, it would be really cool to collaborate. You know, I'm making a bit of a name for myself in the NFT world. What if we collaborated and made a short film that was just an NFT? It was only meant to be sold as an NFT and not seen anywhere else, not exhibited, not published, nothing else. And he's a big technology junkie and he loves new tech, and he thought that was really cool. And then he remembered that there existed this corpse of him made by the incredibly talented ladies at Blackspot FX. And they had done it for a show called Slasher, where he is a corpse. And he thought, you know, maybe if I can reach out to them and see if they could lend us this corpse, then we can make this. And so they did, and they brought the corpse and we placed it in the bed in my childhood bedroom. And I filmed it. He acted in it and directed it. I produced and filmed it, and then we sold it as an NFT. And since then, you know, so many people have discovered it. It's been places, but that was its origin story. And it was a really cool way to work together while also exploring something totally different that none of us had any experience with.
It was a crazy little film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I loved it.
It really was very disturbing for me.
Yeah, I was going to say, seeing your dad's dead body on the...
Yeah, it was cool. It was awful. It was just like the worst. Push yourself as an artist, you know? It's like, you never know what will happen.
And I am just curious, like on the set, like, was your dad laughing about this? Was he trying to make you feel comfortable? Was it...
I mean,
'cause it is an odd situation.
The set, it was just us, just the two of us in my old bedroom. So it was, you know, he was in character. We're both taking it very seriously. I don't usually shoot motion, so it was an interesting challenge for me too. But, you know, when it was done, I kind of exhaled and said, okay, that was something. I don't think I need to necessarily do that again. But, you know, no regrets for anything that you do that's creative and that takes you out of your comfort zone, because it really does push you as an artist. Even if you never look back, it takes you to a place where it's just, I think anything exploratory as an artist is useful.
Well, your dad gave me one of my favorite quotes of all time, which was, he was talking about Hollywood, and he said, Hollywood's always talking about comfort, like the comfort of this contract or the comfort of this or the movies. And he said, I'm just not interested in comfortable cinema.
That's so great. Perfect.
I feel you and your brother believe that too.
I think so. And it's fun to, strangely though, you do feel a comfort working on a film. You're comfortable on set thinking, you know what, I'm going to really push past everyone else's comfort zone because we're all just hanging out as friends on set. So why don't we make something that's really going to disturb people? There is a fun to it. I can't lie.
And what do you have next?
Great question. I am having lots of conversations. Exciting things will hopefully follow these conversations. At this point, nothing is official, nothing to officially disclose, but I am certainly hoping that I'm lucky enough to have an opportunity to make more films, maybe television, all of these things. This is the goal. I love being a photographer. This will always be my first love, and looking forward to a productive 2025 in both realms. And then all the while I am parenting. So it keeps you humble. It's like, we've got two kids. We've got a almost 1-year-old dog. There's never a dull moment. And it gives your brain a real challenge of trying to focus on work while also focusing on everything else. But I think that's why I'm also sort of uniquely positioned in a different way than my dad and my brother. So it gives me a different voice and different experiences. It's something I'm very appreciative of. My family is excited to see what I'll do next too.
Well, so am I. So thank you so much for your time. And I am really looking forward to what you do next.
Thank you. Thank you. You'll be the first to know.
All right. Yes. Keep me posted.
Will do. Thank you so much.
That was Caitlin Cronenberg, director of Humane, which is now streaming on Hulu. And that wraps up another edition of KPBS listener-supported Cinema Junkie. If you enjoy the podcast, then please share it with a friend, because your recommendation is the best way to build an addicted audience. You can also help by leaving a review. And check out Cinema Junkie Presents Midday Movies video podcast on the KPBS YouTube channel. Till our next film fix, I'm Beth Accomando, your resident cinema junkie.
KPBS On Demand is supported by Bilhau Plumbing, Heating, and Air Restoration and Flood Services. Family-owned and operated over 4 decades, Bilhau has been serving the plumbing, heating, and air and water damage needs of the San Diego area since 1980. With their fleet of trained professionals, Bilhau has the ability to service all major and minor plumbing and HVAC emergency needs 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Bilhau is committed to providing excellent service to their customers with transparent quotes and attention to detail on every job. Whether you're in need of an HVAC installation, plumbing, or water damage restoration in San Diego, they offer the convenience of scheduling an appointment over the phone, online, or through live chat on their website. Call 1-800-BILHOW or visit bilhau.com, because we know how.